The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans just like you.
In this issue, I'm not saying she's a gold digger, but her sister is a werecheetah, and none of that is a euphemism. There's a tragedy in Gotham City, the art of Thomas Perkins, not a tragedy, there's a comma there, the inspiration for ReCore, and more, plus our pop culture news, reviews you can use, and never getting tired of my rhyming shoes, plus the kick butt poll of the week. All this, and perhaps a splenectomy, as the Major Spoilers podcast takes to the air for industry.
Welcome to issue 695 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Hey, this week it's a Because You Demanded It episode. We're finally taking a look at Gold Digger. You're saying, wait, I didn't see a poll for that. That's because you need to be a patron. Patreon.com/Major Spoilers. You can find out more on how you can help pick news stories and trade paperbacks for future episodes. It's all over there. Patreon.com/Major Spoilers. Thank you to we hit our 10% milestone.
Woo!
We have 51 Yay. People on our way to 500. To reach our first goal, and I thank everybody who is a part of that. Ashley, I heard you woohoo.
I did.
You've got a lot to woohoo about. First of all, we just talked recently about your comic inclusion that you guys had coming out.
Yes.
And now you have another one, a little 2-page piece in the upcoming Love is Love.
Oh, man, it's only one page. I
oh,
wish
it's only
it was
one page. Okay. Well, I mean, it's really
is.
Crazy because it's like 100 stories, 100 creators for like $9.
Yeah. So the awesome Mark Andreyko, after the Pulse nightclub shooting, decided to put together a anthology that celebrated, you know, basically everything that was good in the world in the wake of everything that was terrible and reacted to that. And it is called Love is Love. And I co-authored a page with the fabulous Jason Inman, and it is drawn by Nick Robles with letters by Taylor Esposito. It has to do with a swan, and when you read it, you'll know what that means. And it just got announced today, so go tell all your friends, go order it up, and it is being put out by DC and IDW, which is pretty freaking cool.
I'm super excited that both these companies are working together, IDW and DC Comics. The cover art is a Batwoman holding an American flag that turns into the rainbow flag. And that's
Raphael Albuquerque,
mm-hmm. which is fantastic. 144 pages for $10. And it is going to the Equality Florida Fund for those affected by the Pulse nightclub in Florida attack. So I think this is a cool thing to have out there for people to show support. And you're getting comics by great creators, including Ashley and Jason. So big thumbs up there. Man, that's
you can get it in December.
I know you can get it into December. I can't wait. The solicitations are out now. The orders will cut off in a couple of weeks in October. So you need to get that done about middle of October is when your orders are due. So get those into your local comic book shop. So congratulations on that, Ashley. It's like, man, you've got comic books coming out your ears.
Oh, man, it only took my whole life.
Well, but hey, right? I mean,
you're 24.
I'm not anymore.
But I mean, that is a good message, right? People have these ideas of here's something that I would love to do. And granted, there's some of us that have a much bigger perspective on things that took us this long to get to. But it does take time, right? It doesn't happen overnight. It's something that you do have to work at. And it is about people that you know and what your capabilities are.
And sometimes just asking to be a part of something pans out pretty nicely.
So how did you approach this project? Did someone come to you and ask, or did you like, hey, we know some people. We heard you're doing this project. We want in on it.
Jason and I, we pitched for it to Mark Andreyko, and then he thought we weren't terrible, so we were allowed to participate. And it's cool because they have a lot of, like, the press release says there's a lot of, like, really impressive people in the book. So not only is it an honor to be able to, you know, write about such a sensitive subject and try to make a change on that front, but to be mm-hmm. included among some of the creators that were in there, like, I'm just blown away that they let us in the front door.
I know. It's Damon Lindelof is one of the contributors, as is Patton Oswalt, Phil Jimenez, mm-hmm. Olivier Coipel, a whole lot more. I think Gail Simone is working on this too. I forget the whole list. It's very amazing and very impressive, and I hope people go out and support it. because it's for a good cause, I think.
It is. And if any of the original art catches your eye, there might be a way to acquire some of that for more good charity work. So keep an eye out for that as well.
Awesome. Also going on this past week, you've had a busy couple of weeks, Ashley. You were at the Long Beach Comic-Con for a panel and some other things. What's Long Beach Comic-Con like? It seems like 6 or 7 years ago, it was just this little Comic-Con that was happening right at the end of the summer, and a lot of people, I think, kind of passed it by. But now, because of its proximity to Hollywood and to now a lot of big publishers, it's kind of grown a little bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even 2 years ago, the expo, which takes place in February, beginning of the year, was definitely just the tiny room upstairs at the Long Beach Convention Center.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely feels like a show like Kamikaze has been that grows a little faster than they kind of know what to do with. And this past Long Beach Comic Con, they had a big Firefly cast reunion, which I guess was a pretty big deal for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet, there a lot of things I would say were a little hinky this time around. I generally really like Long Beach because it does feel a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little less overwhelming than your San Diego or your WonderCon even.
Mm-hmm.
But WonderCon, Long Beach is growing so exponentially. Like, I think they didn't expect what they got this time around, which is super exciting because it means that there's more than just one or two huge cons a year. Like, you can get some really amazing people, creators and actors and directors and all that out. But it also means that sometimes like the internet doesn't work the whole time. And then I don't carry any cash, so I can't buy anything. And like stuff like that becomes really frustrating.
Yeah.
But if you're a person who's working at Long Beach Comic Con and you're invested in that, it's a good problem to have. So overall, it was a really good time.
You had mentioned Stan Lee's Kamikaze. I remember the first year they had that, it was in a parking lot.
Oh my God.
And it was just like, what? I mean, it's got Stan Lee's name attached to it and they're kind of doing it in this back parking lot area. And it, you're right. It has grown.
It's huge
now. Right. And that's like in 5 years or something like that. So I'm glad to see that comic book shows are growing. It seems like there are so many of them going on. I mean, over the Labor Day weekend, we had Dragacon, Boston Comic Con. We had the Canada Fan Expo.
Baltimore was in there somewhere.
Which one?
Baltimore was in
Baltimore
there somewhere.
Baltimore Comic Con. I mean, there were just East Coast, West Coast, in the middle of every place. I mean, there were just Comic Cons coming out all over the place. And they had Salt Lake City Comic Con was going on. They had good attendance at all of those shows, which has got to be good, I think. Overall, because it used to be, you could fill up a C2E2 or a New York Comic Con or a Baltimore or Dragon Con or San Diego. But man, that Denver Comic Con, you think you're really going to fill it up? And yes, they do. You think the Salt Lake City Comic Con is going to do anything? Well, it's now one of the largest, if not the largest, comic book convention out there. What is driving growth to comic book conventions?
Well, one is the accessibility, right? It's not that it's only San Diego. Like when I was growing up, the only conventions I ever knew about were anime conventions in Toronto, and I lived in Toronto. So the fact that there's one in Escondido that I've been to, like they're everywhere.
Well, what's
and that literally means hidden.
Does it?
I think in the city
of industry,
you
learn a little more every day.
I think in the city of industry, at least once a month, they have some little tiny Comic-Con.
Oh, Franklin and Sons. It's dope.
Yeah. It's this little one that's like in a Holiday Inn ballroom or something. So they're all over the place.
I think it's in an industrial space. Like it's a good time. It's very dusty.
Yeah.
But you know, you couldn't do that if there wasn't a demand for it. And now that people know that it's a business and it's being taken very seriously, and someone like Stephen Amell owns half of Heroes and Villains Cons, like, you know, when you like anything, when you take it seriously and then you put the capitalist machine behind it. I'm watching The Americans right now, so I'm going to sound, you know, really like pro-proletariat.
Yeah.
You know, you can make anything happen. You can make anything popular. And you know, certainly the cinematic universe that we live in of it all doesn't hurt either.
Matthew, I mean, you and I have seen Planet Comic-Con go from a little convention inside of a community center basketball court to a huge thing down at the American Royal, whatever that place is, Bartle Hall.
Down
at Bartle Hall. And it's huge. And they brought in the entire cast of Star Trek a couple of years ago, and they had Doctor Who Radagast show up. And yeah, we've renamed the doctors.
Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah. Just so you know, we've renamed the we've got Radagast.
Ugly
we've
coat.
Got Venusian Akito.
Oh, I heard this from okay. Dueling Review.
Okay. All right. So people if people are wondering,
show, man.
Ugly coat. Yeah. So but I mean, we've got you know, comic book conventions are just growing left and right. Do you have some other insight, Matthew? Or are people also going for comic book creators, comic book artists? Are they going for that, or is it all the pop culture stuff attached to these conventions, the stars and the merchandise and that kind of stuff?
I think it's honestly both, and I think a lot of people don't break it down to that level, you know, because we are at a point where the nerdy stuff that in the 80s might get you made fun of is now part of the mainstream pop culture, and that's great. I think it's wonderful that people want to go and see, you know, they want to go and meet Sylvester McCoy, or they want to go and meet Patrick Stewart. I think that it's all kind of tied up into one, and in a lot of ways, that's good, because if you look at our fandom, sometimes we're like, well, the Guardians of the Galaxy that you see in the television show on is different than the one in the movie. That's Earth 1654.
And hey, that's important stuff.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not. Trust me. I'm the person who remembers this stuff, whether I want to or not.
It's a curse.
But I think it's also good to have people say, you know, Linda Carter is the only cool Wonder Woman that ever matters. And that's great. That's legit. I think that people go to these things for all levels of engagement, for all levels of entertainment. Some go for the Nathan Fillion. Some go for the Neil Adams. Some go to see if they can, you know, hang out with somebody like Ashley, who's going to be super famous in a few years, and we're all going to totally ride her coattails.
What do you mean in a few years? She's already starred in television commercials with that guy from Big Bang Theory.
I'm talking like super famous. You know what I'm talking? I'm talking like, you know, that guy who's in everything.
Oh, yeah.
She's going to be that guy.
I want to be that guy so bad, though.
It's going to be something where you're like, it's Patton Oswalt and Ashley, and they're doing a commercial for, like, I don't know, scented candles or something.
Yankee candles. You
can Yankee call candy. My agent. I'll buy that pumpkin spice nutmeg candle that Steven wanted last week.
Oh man, not a candle, but incense.
Oh, there you go.
That's what it is. Rodrigo, conventions have become so much more than just the comic books or the creators. I mean, you have like the 501st that are showing up. You have game rooms that are set up. I mean, there's a lot of other things that can attract people to a convention besides this idea of comic books, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the same way that comic book shops have had to expand what they carry, conventions have kind of become this like one-stop shop for nerdy stuff, and that's why they've blown up, because this way people don't have to travel very far, and you can go to your nearest larger convention and get a chance to see someone you care about, interact with some creator that you like, or, you know, finally get to show off that Flash as a puppet cosplay that you've been working so hard on.
Well, thanks for spoiling my Halloween surprise for everybody, Rodrigo.
Aww.
That's okay. Because, anyway. The other nice thing about conventions is that they're willing to start bringing in names, right? It's not, I mean, at one point, and again, I'm not trying to bag on Planet Comic Con, but at one point it was like every creator in the Kansas City area, maybe out to Chicago, but not really much further than that, would come into the Planet Comic Con, and that's who they had. And then one year they brought in Chewbacca and a Boba Fett.
Peter Mayhew.
And I forget what Boba Fett's...
Dude with glasses.
Bob A. Fett is his name.
Bob A. Fettington.
And the convention exploded. And I think Gail Simone just spent some time in South America going to some conventions and loving it. We're seeing conventions hiring some of the top cosplayers in the world to come to their events and be there to sell their merchandise. It's a great time. And I think the news just keeps getting bigger and bigger when it comes to comic books and pop culture, because in August, check this out. In August, Diamond Comics says that they shipped 10.26 million comics into the direct market. Now, direct market is comic book shops and specialty stores. Doesn't include your B. Daltons or your Barnes & Nobles or any of those. It doesn't include your Walmarts. It's just into the comic book and specialty stores. That's the highest that it has been in a long, long time. What do you guys attribute to that huge demand of comics? I mean, there's a very, I mean, we can certainly take it as a, well, everybody's just into comics now. Hey, everything's great. But there, we could also take a very cynical approach to this
61 news. DC number one issues.
Well,
I mean, I'll take a cynical approach and say that that number is fairly impressive in and of itself, but it's nowhere near what comics were selling, you know, during the war Shazam or days, immediately after that or
yeah.
like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Captain Marvel alone.
Millions of comics.
Oh, yeah. Uncle Scrooge was routinely selling 1 million comics a month at one point.
Like, ridiculous. Amazing. But I think some of it is that the stigma has gone away, and some of it is like there's a big push in accessibility in the specialty stores. Mm-hmm. And you definitely still go into the stores where you're like, oh, it's never been swept in here and everybody's really sweaty.
Yeah.
But those are going by the wayside. But I feel like now we're finally hitting the thing with the movies and the TV where it's okay to like, I feel like reading the comics has always been the thing that hasn't transcended popular culture as much. Like, you can like Batman, but like, do you really want to like read Batman? Like, really?
Yeah, you do. If it's Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, all these guys doing stuff. Heck yes, you want to read Batman's.
Yeah. But now we're finally to that. And I think the conventions are a big part of that because the creators now are getting to be superstars mm-hmm. as much as the characters are. Like, Tom King is a huge deal. You know, Scott Snyder, like, they're big names in and of themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that we're getting back, for better or for ill, I guess, depending on how you want to look at it, we're getting back into the idea that we're consuming these products for the creators as much as because we love mm-hmm. Batman or a Flash or Robin.
Well, part of it, too, I think, is, as we were talking about, there's this big cross-pollination where you've got movie people and TV people and cosplayers and gamers mm-hmm. all coming to these conventions, and suddenly a gamer's like, wait, there's a Munchkin comic, there's a Pathfinder comic, there's a Dungeons & Dragons comic. Oh, man, this is cool. Let me buy some comics.
There are 800 D&D books? What?
Yeah. Marvel is jumping on this costume variant cover thing coming up. They've done it once before. They're doing it again, I think, in October or November. And so you're seeing cosplayers.
October for Halloween.
Yeah, you're seeing cosplayers all over the covers. Now, Valiant followed that up this week with the announcement of they're also doing a cosplay cover, but it's going to be all cats in costume.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cats dressed as Magnus.
Yeah. So you've got all this cross-pollination, but I also think that DC's rebirth had something to do with it, because when we look at the numbers, and also, as Matthew said, the double shipping, DC only had 29 new titles in this rebirth issue, not quite the 52 that they had. Some of them, not all of them, are double shipped, so they're somewhere around 35 or 40 comics in the month. But they were able, for the second month in a row, to take the unit share and the dollar share away from Marvel, knocking them down into second place. I mean, if we look at just the top 10, Marvel only had one comic book in the top 10. That was The Amazing Spider-Man. Also in the, all the rest were DC comics. In the top 20, let's see, The Walking Dead, which continually sells well, was Image Comics at number 13, and Marvel at number 20 was Star Wars number 22. Amazing Spider-Man number 18 was the one that hit the number 4 position. I find that incredibly impressive, and I'm wondering if this assumed promise that DC Rebirth was going to attract the old comic readers who may have walked away with the new 52, if we're seeing some of that pay off, or if it's something else.
I think it's something else. It's certainly partly that. Mm-hmm. There are definitely people who are saying, I will never touch another DC. Oh, wait, it's good. I'm going to read it now.
Yeah.
But then I think we're also seeing, and this is something that does come up, and I'm always leery of it, because when it comes up in the new number ones and the new relaunch vamp boots, you get these bumps, and I want to see the sustainability of
right,
it.
Right.
But there's also a greater question, and something that we're seeing over the last few years. In the 90s, there was a real push to try and get the readers that they had, which at the time was 75 to 100,000 people, to read the books that they were making.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like today there's an attempt to widen the audience and make books that appeal to people who aren't part of the 75,000, 100,000, or
right.
now
I mean,
down to 40,000 people.
When you look at the diversity in comics, it's certainly increased. With Kim and Kim, you've got Gotham Academy, you've got so many other comics that are out there. That are drawing in different audiences. And of course you're getting creators that are backing that too. The Black Panther, for example, is a great example. But I think that is starting to draw some other people into this as well. One thing, Rodrigo, that's interesting to note. Let me just run down the top 10 comics.
Okay.
Oh, before I do that, Matthew, you had said sustainability. Batman number 4 came in at number 6. Batman number 5 sold slightly less at number 7. So I don't know about sustainability, but number 5 did sell less than number 4. For Rodrigo, number 1 comic, Harley Quinn number 1.
Right.
Number 2, All-Star Batman. Number 3, Suicide Squad. Number 4, Amazing Spider-Man. Number 5, Suicide Squad Rebirth. Number 6 and 7, as I already mentioned, Batman 4 and 5. Number 8, Justice League. Harley Quinn number 2 at number 9. And Supergirl Rebirth number 1. I wonder if there's anything that could possibly cause those 10 titles to bounce up there at the top of the stack.
Right. Well, obviously, take all the Batmans out, because Batman always performs well. It's like those 75,000 people that were ever reading comics are all reading Batman. They have to. It's like you get it with the card when you become a comic nerd. It's like, and here's your card. Here's your issue of Batman. But everything else, yeah, obviously there are all of these tie-ins. And what we were seeing very early on with the Marvel movies and stuff, everybody was looking at it and they were like, saying, why aren't we seeing this like huge upswell, right? It's like Iron Man's on in the movie theater. Everybody loves it. Captain America, Thor. Well, maybe not Thor so much. Thor did okay. And they were like, why aren't we just seeing these numbers reflected in comic book sales? And it took him a long time to really gear everything to where that would happen. And I think what we're seeing is this kind of slow rise rather than this like sudden meteoric explosion. We're looking at this thing where comic book or superhero stuff is now in the media consistently all the time. There's good superhero stuff. There's bad superhero stuff. There is TV versions. There are animated versions. There are comedy versions. There are independent comic book or superhero movies and stuff like that. So it's kind of legitimized the genre, and it's something that now the people that would normally pursue things like this are now being led into comics because this is where it comes from. You know, like that friend that you have that hurried up and read all of the available Game of Thrones books because they wanted to be the guy that knew what was going to happen in Game of Thrones. Now you can do that with comic books, except it's a lot harder to decipher because any given movie they pick and choose from, you know, 1,000 different issues of 1,000 different versions of Batman.
Well, certainly Suicide Squad movie plays a big role in 3 of these titles being up there on the list, or 4 of these titles being on the list. And I would argue that Batman v Superman had some impact maybe on the Batman titles and the Justice League title. And CW and CBS with Supergirl had to have had an impact in getting that in the number 10 position.
Well, and you could say that with Civil War and Spider-Man too. Mm-hmm. It's weirdly that Spider-Man feels a lot more
like comic book
A lot closer. Yeah, a lot closer to the source material than the like kind of basketball skin Spider-Man that we've been seeing.
Now there are a couple of interesting things to note in this list. Not a single title on this list was part of a subscription box service. Oftentimes, you'll see like a Marvel comic or something sell 400,000 copies, and that's a loot crate
subscription.
It
happened with that Orphan Black book, like 2 years ago. It was like the top selling comic, and it was like nobody reads the Orphan Black book.
Well, because it was the loot crate thing, right? The other thing that people need to take in mind when we share this complete list of the top 300 comics or the market share data, these are comics that the retailer bought, right? These are not a reflection of the actual books that got into the hands of readers. And so that might put things into a bigger perspective, especially if, and I don't remember if Harley Quinn number 1 had a bunch of variant covers or if there were incentives to buy more. The other thing is when you see a little asterisk by some of these titles, that often indicates that those titles were returnable or a percentage of those were returnable. So it does encourage stores to order, you know, instead of 20 copies of Harley Quinn, they're encouraged to order 200 copies of Harley Quinn because some of those would be returnable and the store's not out.
Really, that's the last step. That's the last hurdle for comic books as a medium is that idea that we get all our numbers as far as what the retailer bought,
right,
instead of what's actually making it to people's hands and eyeballs,
well,
as it were.
It's even more frustrating because the numbers that we are given by Diamond are not actual numbers sold, right? So we know that Batman,
right,
is the benchmark, and they always have that as an index of 100. So whatever Batman sold, anything above that sold as a multiple of however many copies Batman sold, and anything below mm-hmm. that is also based on that number. But we never know what that number is. When you see an index number of 100, that doesn't mean 100,000 copies of Batman were sold in the direct market. It just means that that's their benchmark number, and everything is higher or lower than that. But when we look at this, we can see that Harley Quinn number one has an index of 235.29, which means it sold 2.5 times better than Batman number four. But it's not an indicator of the actual numbers. Now, there are some sites like ICV2. I've talked with them before, and I've been told by other sources that their numbers are within 5 to 10% correct as far as the numbers they report. And I've also had other people who tell me, oh, no, those numbers are way, way, way off. And as far as comic book readers go, usually I use the number of about 150 to 200,000. And I had a former comics journalist contact me this last week and said, yeah, I heard you talking about this the other day. When I was working in the industry, someone at Marvel told me that the actual number was somewhere around 350 to 360,000 people buying and reading comics regularly. So I don't know what the number is, and I'm not sure anybody knows what the number is. Ashley, you work for a comic book company. Do you know what your actual readership is out there, or has there been a number thrown around of how many actual comic book readers are currently purchasing comics?
Well, I don't have any access to our number.
Okay. Well, I'm not saying about your numbers specifically, but I'm sure at some point you said that, hey, we've got, 300,000 people are reading comics. Here's where we stack up against that.
Not in any meeting I've ever been
okay.
in.
All right.
Most of mine are like, oh, when is this book coming out?
Yeah.
I think that's impossible to track, though, because digital, on top of the fact that, like, I do know this from working in the shop, that your average person who comes in, everyone, your Wednesday warrior spends $40 to $60. So that's not just picking up one book. So if you sell 100,000 comics, a certain percentage of them are all going to the same people,
yeah, so
on top
like
of it.
10 to 25,000 people.
Yeah. And then there's digital sales, and mm-hmm. then there's people who torrent, and then there's people who borrow them from friends.
Yeah. And then there's your Walmart copies and your B. Dalton copies. So it would be nice if we could track that, but I think it is
all
impossible.
Of these.
It's kind of like the Nielsen ratings, where you kind of give an estimate of how many people are watching something. And two share seems like a big deal these days.
No, it's not impossible, because you don't get comic books over the air. You buy individual copies of comics from a retailer. You don't think Walmart knows exactly how many copies of a Walmart comic they sell?
Right, but they
do.
But again, as Ashley
all
said,
of this
they
information,
know they know how many copies are sold. They don't know how many copies were bought by the same person. Someone going in and buying 10 copies of something.
Oh, I see. Yeah. The thing is, all of this information is deliberately obscured.
Mm-hmm,
Diamond obscures it. The retailers obscure it. The comic book companies, don't want to know. And they would rather just shoot stuff at the wall and see what sticks than actually try to sit down and figure these out, because the economical forces at work want these numbers to stay hidden. We could figure all this out, but good luck getting the strongest, largest delivery corporation to tell you any of their numbers when they've got you over a barrel and there's no other game in town.
Right. And Matthew, I think you had mentioned before that, just because a comic is in the number one spot doesn't mean that every comic book reader bought Harley Quinn number one.
Right. And that's something else to keep in mind, is I think that 350 is very high. But I think that based on what the numbers seem to be for a vaguely healthy, not going to get canceled title. And then you also have to take into account, there are people who will buy multiple copies, but that phenomenon, I think, is separate. And I think that the focus on how many units sold to the retailers is problematic, but I think trying to figure out how many actual readers is kind of beside the point. The question that I want to know is, once they get to the retailers, how many are actually sold?
Yeah.
How many are you sitting on? Because, I mean, X-Men number one in 1993 sold a million copies. I personally chucked at least 100 of them in a dumpster.
Right.
And probably another 50 more into the quarter bins. So it's something that I don't know if I'm really interested in how many people are out there buying, but I am interested in how many copies are actually leaving the stores, leaving the imaginary B. Daltons, leaving
the
borders.
It's not imaginary. It's a real thing.
Leaving the Hastings, leaving the other things, you know, and.
Oh no, Hastings is out of business.
Yeah.
Shut up. But yeah, I think that Rodrigo is exactly right. People don't want us, and by us, I mean a general public person, to know these things. Because right. As long as you have that ambiguity, you can make the argument, and you see this on TV all the time. It's the number one drama. And then there's an asterisk. Right. Among 18 to 24-year-olds at 7 p.m. on a Sunday when the bells ring.
Right. Or you look at ratings and you're like, oh, a two-share or something today is celebrated as a great deal. You know, back in the 1970s, your show would have been canceled before you hit the opening credits with that.
Well, yeah, but there were three channels in the 1970s.
Right. I know.
Now there are 500.
But, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm curious because you said there's a purpose to keep it hidden. And to kind of transition over to TV, Netflix is that same way. They don't want people to know how many are watching Stranger Things or Narcos or they didn't do Fuller House, did they?
Yes, they did.
They don't want people to know how well those did. But there are outlets out there like HBO is super proud to say that once again, Game of Thrones is the most pirated show out there, even though none of those people are subscribers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's a measure of popularity, and both HBO claiming that and Netflix obscuring their numbers, it allows them to do the same thing, which is to say, guys, this is a super popular show. And anytime somebody's like, well, let me see some numbers, they're like, no.
It would be too difficult to assemble those numbers.
Because then, the evidence is entirely anecdotal, right? You're like, well, my coworker watched Stranger Things and my mom saw the girl from Stranger Things on a late night talk show. Therefore, this show must be popular. It's like the natural label on any food product is like, it doesn't actually mean anything. People have been ascribing things to it. And now it's like a viable form of marketing. So this allows Netflix to boost up shows that aren't doing that well and being like, no, you guys should get Netflix because everybody loves this. And the same way that it allows, people within the companies, within like, you know, any of the big two to be like, you know what character was really popular? Nova Fist. Let's do another comic with Nova Fist. And they're like, I don't think he was that popular. It's like, well, who can even tell? Diamond doesn't tell us anything. Let's try it again because I love that guy.
Yeah. Mm. I'm sticking by 150 to 200,000 active comic book readers. That's what I'm going to stick with.
Well, sure. I mean, with no real way to prove or disprove it, I think you're fine.
So
it's a good guess. One day this will be cracked wide open. Yeah, someday some enterprising
not
journalist
the 10 years we've been doing
crack
it
open.
It's going to be 57 guys hidden in a basement.
Yeah,
not I think usual. It's hard. It's hard for us though because I think so many of the people that surround us are like reading comics. Yeah, so yeah. I think we want to assume that it's maybe a larger demographic than perhaps it is.
Right. I mean, all you have to do is just walk outside and interact with a non-comic book reading person to find just how little people read
comics.
Do
I have to?
Yeah.
All day, every day.
So here's the question. You brought up Hastings as a company that's imploded upon itself because it markets on comic books and pop culture stuff. We're seeing comic conventions at an all-time high. We're seeing comic book sales in the direct market, at least to the comic book shop, at an all-time high. Predictions for September. Does this number drop or does it stay consistent? Now, compared to last month, compared to this time last year, we're only, I think I want to say 8% above where we were this time last year, 8% up from last month and 44% up from August of 2015. But overall comic sales for this year are only up 0.06% compared to this time last year. So a little bit of a blip, and certainly August is going to help that. But what happens in September? Make some predictions. Stay the same, drop, or increase? Ashley?
I think we're going to see a pretty steady increase until the holidays, and then I think it's going to drop.
Okay.
Fairly dramatically, as December tends to do to all consumer products.
Mm-hmm. Matthew?
Historically speaking, dating back as far as I can remember and as far as anybody that, you know, the historical old nerds speak of these days, number threes sell less than number twos, which sell less than number ones. I believe that we are going to see a decrease, but I expect that we're still going to be above where we were last year with the Rebirth number threes, the Clone Conspiracies, the Civil Wars wrapping up, all the things going on. But I do believe that we're going to see less simply because of the fact that we did have a ton of number ones and a ton of quality number ones flooding the market over a very short time frame. And then you get the twos in there, you get the threes in there. I think we're going to see it kind of trending downward, but still in a fashion that it's like this is above what we expected,
okay, so
above
Ashley,
what we've seen historically.
Ashley says for next month up. Matthew says slightly down. Rodrigo, what do you say?
Ooh.
I say probably slightly down for the reason that fall tends to be a time for new media, mostly podcast, new TV podcast. Shows.
Oh, I thought you meant podcast new media.
Well, that too. So, you know, a few movies popping up here and there. But honestly, I don't know if it's a big September release, if September specifically is a big time for the release, but the fall overall is a big time for new TV shows and actually new video games. A lot of video games drop in the fall. So the people that are hungry for sci-fi and action tales can actually find them somewhere else without actually having to move very far from their computer. Then again, you can do that too with comic book subscriptions. Okay. I think that competition gets tighter as the year, basically from here on out, competition gets harder for comics, culminating in December, which is like death.
The dead
just
zone.
From new movies and, you know, whatever new Star Wars project is dropping, it's just going to be very difficult.
I'm going to say it's going to go up slightly. Not by a whole lot, but at least by 1%, only because if Suicide Squad continued for as long as it did in the theaters and continued to make money for as long as it did, it seems to me comic books can struggle on with that in the next month as well and surprise a bunch of people.
Getting people to buy a number one is easy. Getting people to come back every month, to remember to come back, to stay focused enough to come back or have the story engagement enough to come back.
Well,
month over month is a different matter.
Well,
or to hop in the middle if you miss the number one.
Yeah.
And that is why November 19th, 2016 is Local Comic Shop Day. This is where the retailers and the publishers and Diamond Comics celebrate your local comic shop on November 19th, 2016, just before the Thanksgiving break, just before all those cool movies drop in the theater. You can go to your local comic shop. You can get some exclusive. There are going to be a bunch of exclusives there. I guess there's 27 different items that are going to be released, including the Champions number one with the Neil Adams cover. If you're into that, some toy exclusives, some Killer Frost. What is it? A Killer Frost limited edition statue that you'll only be able to get on those days. Over 300 stores have already signed up for this. Your local comic shop may be involved. Don't leave them out in the wind. If you want your local shop to participate, contact them and say, hey guys, did you know about Local Comic Shop Day? Are you guys participating? Contact them. We want to come and celebrate you. We want to make sure that people know that you exist. And also, what are you doing with Free Comic Book Day on October, the Halloween Fest? And also, what's coming up with Free Comic Book Day coming up in the next month?
Don't ask all the questions.
No, but definitely get your local comic shop to sign up for Local Comic Shop Day. It's coming up November 19th, 2016.
LSD for short.
And if you want to head over to majorspoilers.com, there's all sorts of stuff over there, including news about Star Trek getting delayed until May of 2017. A whole bunch more stuff can only be found at majorspoilers.com. New stuff is done. That was a great conversation. Thank you, guys. Let us jump into some reviews. And I'm going to start things off this week. Came in the mail today. I knew it had been out a couple of weeks. And I should say this. Everyone here is personal friends with Thomas Perkins. Okay?
Sure.
He has
collaborated with him on a project once.
He has done the art for Major Spoilers in the past. He's designed the character t-shirts for our Critical Hit characters that you can find at our Major Spoilers store. So we are friends with Thomas Perkins, but I am more than happy to talk about his new art book, If, that just came out. Not to be confused with Ashley's project, If, right? Isn't that the one?
If Anthology.
If Anthology. So don't confuse the two. But they did come out around the same time. But if you like, I mean, if you like Ben 10, if you like the Batman, if you like Green Lantern, the animated series, if you like Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, you know his art because he's been all over that for decades. And he's come out with a new art book that is fantastic. And here's what I like about Perkins art. A lot of times you see people come out with their sketchbooks or other things that feature a lot of your well-known characters. You know, they'll put a Spider-Man pinup or something in there or whatever. None of that's here. These are all Perkins originals. And if you follow him on Instagram or you follow him on Facebook or wherever else that he is out there, or his Thomas Perkins art page, you know that he comes up sometimes with these amalgams of characters where he'll smash Batman and Wolverine together and you'll get a weird character like that, or you'll just get something totally different. His Kid Cthulhu stuff is fantastic. That's what's in this book. And every page is, you know, big images, small images. There's even a little Kablamicus appearance in this issue, manga Kablamicus. It's all in this book and it is super great. And best of all, if you order this book from him, I didn't realize this until I flipped the page and I was like, oh, here's a cool monster wrapping around his logo. And it says for Steven on there. And I'm looking at him like, that's pretty cool printing that they did this. And then I flipped back a page and said, oh, there's some ink bleeding through. Oh, this is an original sketch. You can order this with an original sketch in there. So thank you.
Wait,
Thomas,
I'm
for doing
Steven.
Thank you for doing this. There's also a couple of shout outs to the Major Spoilers people in this book in the thank you section. But I just want to kind of talk about this because it is really good. It is worth your time to pick up. If you haven't seen his lunchtime blog, it is the best because every day he takes lunch bags and he draws art on it for his three kids. And separately, they're a standalone panel. But if you join them together, it's a giant, triptych image. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic and worth checking out. You'll see some of that in this book. It's If. I'm going to give it 5 stars, 5 slices of meatloaf, and I think everyone knows why. But again, I said that that we know him personally, so there's definitely a lot of bias in this review. My biggest disappointment in this book is that it doesn't have more pages. I need If 2, Electric Boogaloo, Mr. Perkins. Get that going on, because
actually the second one should be called If Then.
If Then.
Ah, nice.
This book is $34.95. You can pick it up from thomasperkinsart.com/shop. Definitely worth your time. Beautiful art inside. I'm glad to put this on my shelf. I'm glad to put it on the coffee table. I'm glad to show it to anybody that walks in the Major Spoilers HQ. So If from Thomas Perkins. Go check it out. All right. Maybe some overly biased reviews. Why don't we start with Ashley? Oh my gosh. I want to know about this movie that we have been hinting at and talking about for a long time, The Blair Witch.
So I want to start this off with an apology. I was going to do this as a nice video review for the Major Spoilers channel, and I've had a really bad job at planning my life the last couple of weeks.
Oh, we understand.
So I co-opted it for this podcast.
That's fine.
So this is going to be as spoiler free as I can manage. So,
you know, you might want to just turn down your headphones.
Hear you, la, la,
so,
la.
You know, the Blair Witch, right? And the girl who went missing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Heather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out she had this secret brother that we never heard about.
This
is his super secret film school project where they have super secret Bluetooth headphones that are also cameras and a super secret drone. So that way we can do crane shots in the forest. Okay. So he's got a white girlfriend, a black girlfriend, and a black guy friend, and two icky white people friends who are kind of like racist, but get to come on the adventure anyway.
Okay.
So they go in the woods and, you know, stuff happens, but it all seems kind of silly. And they think they see some Blair Witch things, but it turns out to be fake until it turns out to not be fake. And then they kill the funniest actor first, who's exactly the actor who you think that they killed first, which is a really unfortunate choice. Mm. And once they get that out of their system for about an hour, the last half an hour of this movie is, this is going to be spoilery, in 3, two, one, exactly the same as the original.
Wow.
So, non-spoilery anymore, this movie to me proved that if you want an interesting, innovative horror movie, you shouldn't let a big movie studio make it, because there are two ideas that are introduced in this movie that are really interesting. The fact that the lead of this movie is tied directly into the lead of the previous movie could have been really interesting if they had followed it into a more natural conclusion, as opposed to forcing it into the nice little box they wanted it to fit in. And there is some play with perception and time dilation. And that is an idea that, again, I think is very fascinating. And you don't need special effects to pull off. You can just do it with a couple lines and gets really left behind in the dust. So there's so much about this movie that is good, but none of it pays off. And they spend so much of the end just shoving it back in the Blair Witch box, but it's not 1990 whatever. And we don't all think this is found footage. Like, the gig is up on it. So I would say, don't go see this in the theater unless you are like a diehard horror person and you're going to go see all the horror movies anyway, because I don't think there's enough to justify the cost or the time, because it gets really boring after like an hour when they kill the most interesting person exactly the way you think they're going to, because it's a horror movie. And it's kind of a bummer because Adam Wingard, the director of this, has done a couple other horror projects that are really cool. And you can see that there's promise there, but it's just like, it's so unsatisfying, which is like so vexing because it could have been so great. So for having like a pretty good idea and having like a pretty funny actor who made it most of the way through the movie, I'll give it two slices of meatloaf. Like, I've seen worse movies this year, but this might be the movie I'm the most disappointed in so far, unfortunately.
Does this suffer, do you think, most from remake-itis?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, definitely. Right. And from having too much money, like, because they don't have to innovate, which is what was so great about the first one. Like, they only had a crappy camcorder, so they had to give you reasons as to why they had a crappy camcorder. It's a trope that not seeing the monster is way scarier than seeing the monster. And the second movie forgets that. Yeah. But that's a trope for a reason.
Yeah. Matthew, you haven't seen this yet?
No.
Okay. Well,
I don't go to the movies in the theater very often.
All right. Well, I knew you were excited about it, and I didn't know if you had gone to see it on opening weekend or not. So
if I did go to the movies, it would never be on opening weekend.
It's probably a better experience to watch it under your blanket anyway. There are a couple of really good jump scares. Good.
You got to understand, I watched a terrible movie called Unfriended not so long ago, and I kind of liked it. So, you know, I'm really okay with a movie being really, really dumb.
Well, yeah.
Hooray!
All right, I reviewed an art book. Rodrigo, you have an art book to review as well.
I do. It is The Art of Recor. It is a video game that is coming out in September. Look out, comic books. The art book isn't coming out in September. The video game is. So Recor is this kind of like post-apocalyptic looking game that involves you playing a cute girl protagonist who is aided by a bunch of robots that I believe you get to change in design. So that's nice. So this is the art book for it. And so first off, this was sent to us digitally by Dark Horse. So I can't speak about like the heft of the book, which is actually something that's important with art books, right? You know, it's like how pretty is this going to look on your coffee table? Cannot speak to that, unfortunately. That said, the art in it is great. I often find myself really happy with art books, even for games that I didn't like, right? Because There's something that's very satisfying, something that's very cool about seeing all the iterations that things went through.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of sketches, a lot of preliminary sketches, a lot of like commentary by the creators where they're like, this was supposed to glow, but that was difficult, so we did this instead, you know? And that's why things look the way they look. The look of ReCore is very interesting. It's this very industrial look for the robots, but they really work very hard to make them cute, basically. If you've seen any of the art, they have kind of a scud look to them a little bit. And that kind of like cute industrial kind of thing. Like a lot of things are like safety yellow and like kind of a black steel kind of look. But because they have like these ocular receptors and because they have kind of these like motion activated cameras and stuff that look like little faces. Specifically, they talk about power cells, because in this world, like basically everything's a robot and every robot has a personality. So everything that you encounter is like a thing, like a person.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about like these power cells that are like deliberately supposed to be small and cute, because in the game you're supposed to get them and like plug them into places. So they're supposed to be like kind of like helpless, like little baby robots that you take to where they belong. So and you know, this is something that you might not get. I mean, you would get maybe subconsciously if they're playing the game, but it's nice to see it explained. And just have them like talk about what their process was. So really that's the real value. You know, I haven't played the game. I can't tell you if it's any good, but I can tell you that it looks good. Probably the highlight of the book is their safety signs.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, these robots have personalities. They're basically sentient. They have all these signs that say, they're kind of like that, you know, like the bathroom guy getting into trouble kind of things. They have one with a robot on it that says, your head is hard, theirs are not. Please check all humans for safety gear. Then there's one with like an arm crushing a human, like a hand, like a robot hand crushing a human arm that says, humans are tender, please touch gently. So there's a lot of, I mean, it tells you, like it immediately tells you so much about this world and about what's going on. That first off, you don't program this into robots. You have to remind them of it. And then also that there's kind of all these other stuff going on. Some mysteries in the game that might be a little spoilery. I think because they knew when this was going to be released, they deliberately left out some spoilers of it. But, you know, there's kind of enough to pique some interest. Altogether, I am going to give this one, let's see, where's my, oh yeah, 4.5 slices of meatloaf. I'm a big fan of art books. I really like the look of ReCore. Is a game that I've been kind of keeping an eye out since they've announced it. I'm probably not going to buy the game itself right away because funds are tight, but I'll definitely try to get my hands on it at some point.
Very cool. All right, Matthew, now it's time for an actual comic book review.
Yay,
I don't know how to take the ending of this this issue, so feel free to spoil away and tell us about Detective Comics 940, featuring someone not on the cover.
Batman.
No, Batman's on the cover.
Detective Comics number 940. Yes, that's the issue. Okay, so here's the deal in this issue. Batman and Batwoman have been teaming up to train a new group of heroes, including Spoiler and whatever Cassandra Cain is called these days.
Orphan.
Orphan? That's a terrible name.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Tim Drake as Red Robin and a Clayface. And they have apparently been... I have not been reading this book, by the way. So I picked this book up cold because Steven said, oh my God, something happened. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check this out. So they have been fighting a group of heavily militarized armored Batmen under the command of Batwoman's father.
Dun dun dun.
Now, normally I would look at something like that and go, this could be good, this could be awful, this is something that, wow, you got to play it really careful when the bad guy is the main hero's dad. And as this issue opens, I have hope.
I have hope. Batman is like, we're not losing anyone today. Red Robin is in a dangerous fight at Wayne Tower. And Batwoman shows up and says, I think you lost this one all on your own, Dad. I am not a fan of the dialogue in this book, by the way. Now, that is not to say that it's all bad. There are just a lot of verbal and dialogue-ridden cliches within this book. While Batwoman fights her father, Batman tries to make his way back to Wayne Tower, where Red Robin, is fighting off a whole bunch of Bat Daddy's evil drones. So, most of this book is actually set up for a big dramatic moment. Over the radio, he's like, Bruce, I love you, Bruce. Tell them all I'm sorry. Thank you for everything. And then he's like, Stephanie, I love you. Rose Tyler, never mind. That's a different story. And Red Robin faces down against these terrible, destructive drones and totally gets annihilated. D-E-A-D. Tim Drake is blown to smithereens. That's
Boo.
Your spoiler.
Boo.
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 And we see Red Robin.
Boo.
We see everyone. Clayface is like, and Alfred is like, and Nightwing is like, and the Orphan is crying because they made me call myself the Orphan, Daddy.
Her and Tim used to kiss.
Oh, they were kissing true. In this issue too, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are a couple of really sweet moments here. Spoiler goes off by herself. Batman makes a point of finding her to make sure she's okay. And there's a moment where Batman and Spoiler just hug and they're both in tears as the rain falls outside because it always rains when someone dies. That's just the rule. And then as the issue starts to close, we see a flash of teleportation energy. And we totally see Tim Drake, Red Robin. And he's totally trapped in a cell. And some dude is like, what a pleasure to have you join us. And Tim actually says to him, this isn't over. This is, during their conversation. My God, the dialogue is problematic in this issue. Oh, my God.
Well, the way you're saying it, yes, I can see that.
No. Don't even. Do not come at me with that. I will tell you right now that I like the basic plotting of this issue.
Yeah.
I like the last word of the issue. Tim Drake in a box saying, my friends will come for me. My friends will come. That's a good moment. It opens well, aside from some really questionable dialogue and a couple of plot points that I'm like, man, come on, give me something to love here. And of course, the man in the hood is implied.
Dr. Oz?
To be Mr. Oz.
Yeah, okay.
Is implied to possibly be Ozymandias.
Right.
Mr. Oz, he's not Doctor.
I'm sorry, got my Oz's confused.
Not that Dr. Oz
gonna,
is actually.
He's
going to
pull
either,
off the cloak and reveal he's the long lost Frank Albom.
Let's not spread those rumors either.
He's going to pull back his hood and he's going to give us a miracle weight loss cure. But this is the thing: when you're reading a book like this and you come in cold, there's always a difficulty, and they do manage to get me right into this plot. There's none of this stuff where I'm like, wait, who's what? Who? What? We start with fight. Batman says, this is happening. And they kind of folded it into the story where Batman is talking to his friends and evil Bat Daddy is listening in from his floating cave of wonders filled with evil Batman and drones. And I felt like that was really well done. If the dialogue was a little bit stronger, this could have been a four slice of meatloaf affair.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stuff that happens here, I really like it. I like the emotional heft of actually admitting that Stephanie Brown exists and that she had a relationship with Tim and that it meant something somewhere along the line. I like an emotional Batman who realizes that he's training children to be soldiers and that he has to give them a little bit of leeway. I like Tim Drake heroically doing something. It's not really a sacrifice. He just sort of kind of stands there. But I think the implication is that he's tracking
Buying
all of
time.
These drones away. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically keeping the drones occupied with blowing him away so that they don't go and destroy everyone else, which, again, all of this comes together into a sort of a melange. And then you have that really interesting hook at the end of what are they doing? because they've basically made it textually part of the story, the way they treat Tim Drake in the real world, which is to say he's a character in the middle that they don't know what to do with and they can't do anything. And Mr. Oz actually comes out and says, "You are so loved, so deeply intertwined. It was crucial that we take you off the field."
Yeah.
It's almost like a meta statement about the way DC treats these mid-range legacy characters like Tim Drake, like Stephanie Brown, like Cassandra Cain. Mm-hmm. But when you're putting it in a story that does the same thing, I'm just like, man, where is this going? I mean, so all in all, three slices of meatloaf for Detective Comics number 940. That was a spoilery, spoilerator affair. But luckily for you, it's been out for a week. So
yeah.
If you wanted to read it, you probably did.
Yeah. Here's my
and
problem.
It is good to know that he's not dead
yet.
He's not dead.
No, he's not. Here's my problem with Rebirth so far. And it can be easily corrected. Just like they could have done with the multiverse, and they did sort of
if
with
you say the word 52, I'm hanging up.
No. There's this whole thing with Mr. Oz and the big blue hand and the comedian and maybe Rorschach running around as the Joker. The main what's really going on with Rebirth threads have popped up in Teen Titans, the Detective Comics and Flash. But if you, Matthew, who've not read any of this, suddenly pop on and you don't, and I guess Mr. Oz has shown up in Superman too. If you're reading this and like, well, who the heck is this guy? Or maybe you're someone who's into this whole bigger conspiracy theory and you want to see where all these little threads are attached. I think DC needs to put something on the cover that says a rebirth tie-in or something, so that people know that, hey, I want to know what's going on with this investigation that the Flash and Batman are doing. You know, give me a clue so I know to buy this comic. I think that's my big problem so far. I mean, if that's my only problem so far, I mean, it's a minor thing. But I mean, if people really want to get all the clues, I think DC's missing an opportunity on this. So, anyway.
It has the Rebirth cover. It has the Rebirth, what do you call that thing with the curtain? The
banner?
Logo?
The curtain banner thing, where they've pulled back the curtain on a new DCU. So, I mean, I don't know. I'll give them props for going back to the old numbering, even though we know they did it for the big 1,000 episode snort that's going to come around.
We're going to slowly catch up to Detective Comics. We'll probably hit 1,000 before they hit 1,000.
What?
We're going to hit issue 1,000 of the Major Spoilers podcast before they hit 1,000.
Well, they've got 60 issues to go, and they're shipping every 12 minutes, so they should be to issue 1,000 by October 17th, if they do it right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you guys for your review. Some really good stuff this week, as well as some good stuff over at majorspoilers.com. If you want to know what's going on in the latest issue of Astro City, Matthew has sat down with Kurt Busiek and has chatted with him once again, as he does every month, to find out what's going on inside
it's the weirdest thing ever. It is the most I have ever obsessed over anything I ever write in my life is that monthly letter to Kurt Busiek. Do I sound like an idiot?
Yeah.
Well, Kurt, does he? Please write us podcast. It is. Majorspoilers.com.
Well, it's Kurt. I mean, Kurt wrote Astro City, and Astro City is like 100 perfect comics.
It is amazing that even in that, when you open it, you don't take the time to correct it. You're just like, excuse me, Kurt. I mean, Mr. Busiek, sir. I'm sorry. Anyway, I sound so stupid. Hang on a second. I'm going to just restart this whole thing. Like, right. Thing is in there.
Yeah, yes. It's all in there. And also the point where I'm like, damn it, you sound like an idiot. Matthew. Oh, man, stupid. What's wrong with you?
And
stupid,
and he actually types in the sound effect of him hitting his head with a book.
Kidding.
Yeah. I don't understand that, but you know, whatever.
Question three is like, you remember when the comedian was in that comic? Yeah, that was cool.
It is definitely a mystery. Oh, speaking of mysteries, it's time for the Major Spoilers Poll of the Week. I'm sorry, I forgot who wrote in this week to suggest this. But.
It says it came from a man named Poll Weekly.
Poll Weekly.
From Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
When it comes to the paranormal, and I like the paranormal like nobody's business. I like the ghost stories. I like the UFOs. I like the devil worshiping stuffs. The things that go bump in the night. The elevator to the 10th floor. All that stuff.
And that's just his first date.
Yeah, boy. Question this week is, which paranormal investigators would you trust to save you? Now, this isn't your favorite. This is the paranormal investigators. Would you, which ones would you trust to save you? Would it be Mystery Inc., that's Scooby-Doo and the gang, or do you trust the X-Files, Mulder and Scully? Ashley, who would you pick to save you?
Well, there's only one of these things I've ever experienced. And there's only one of them that doesn't have David Duchovny, who looks like he's stuffed inside a sausage now. So I'm definitely going to go Mystery Inc. because Scooby-Doo is like the coolest thing ever. And if you're not reading Scooby Apocalypse, what is wrong with you?
Right,
it's now an ongoing series. It's perfection. It may or may not be what I'm planning to be for Halloween. And I think I could rely on their dumb luck because nothing bad ever happens to them. And I may not have seen X-Files, but I've had a lot of people tell me about it. And I do know that horrible things happen to those guys on the regular.
All the time.
And I don't know if I want to deal with that. Plus, Scooby and Shaggy always have a ton of snacks, and everybody's wardrobe is on point. So definitely Mystery Inc.
Okay, Matthew?
There is a very important in-universe rationale for my answer, because as with any of these, I'm presuming that I live in the world where they do when I'm asking to be saved. And as such, my answer is predicated on this. Dana Scully was captured in season one and apparently eaten by sharks and, I don't know, operated on by alien extraterrestrial aliens who then took all her eggs and used them to build a Fusilli Jerry Seinfeld or something. But if you watch the original Scooby-Doo, and this is the problem that people don't realize when they keep coming back to it, is there are no actual supernatural elements in classic Scooby-Doo. It's all old guys with rubber masks. And as such, I know I won't be abducted by aliens and have my sperm rebuilt into a Fusilli Jerry Seinfeld. So I chose Mystery Inc. because I know that they're not going to be saving me from alien conspiracies from beyond space led by a cigarette smoking man, but in fact by old Mr. Wiggins, who's played by Don Knotts. And they'll probably be saving me with Davy Jones and Mama Cass, both of whom I kind of miss. So yeah. I went with Scooby-Doo.
They're going to save you with a couple of dead corpses in the back of their truck. Okay.
No. Davy Jones and Mama Cass are alive.
Yeah, cartoon Davy Jones.
They're always forever, going to be alive. Cartoon Davy will sing that cool. Like, Jerry Reed is still alive.
Yeah.
Batman is still alive.
Oh, Batman is still alive. He never dies.
Oh, Batman died in the 80s.
Man. Rodrigo, what about you, man?
Didn't you play the album backwards? Batman is dead. Batman is dead.
That was a weird inclusion for Chicago on that right? B-side, but
it was.
In any case, as much like I honestly really agree with Matthew, and as much as I would like to hear Scully and Mulder, like basically as they're pulling out some kind of alien apparatus from my belly button for Scully to be like, there's a perfectly rational explanation for this. And, you know, like try to reconcile that. The fact that the Mystery Inc. gang very rarely deals with just stuff that is like effed up to the max the way that the X-Files do would make me want to be saved by them, unless it was from the 13th Ghost of Scooby-Doo, because then I'd be like, well, I don't know if all these guys are on the up and up. They were hanging out with a gypsy guy who went by Flim Flam, which is like really just not cool.
Just think, though, you could punch Flim Flam if you existed in that world.
I guess that's true. Just like pull him aside and be like, listen, man, as the two darkest skinned people here, we have to really talk about your act. Like, this is not how.
This is not cool, man. This is not cool.
Yeah, come on, man. Straight
now. Living in the world of Mystery Inc. means that I get to punch Scrappy-Doo when they save me, I'm in.
Scrappy-Doo, man, he's a fighter.
Yeah, he'll scrap.
I'm all for punching.
It's like half pit bull and part dodge dart.
I went with Mystery Inc. too, because I think that bottom line is, if you follow the newspapers, and I'm sure that the only reason why these guys are able to continue doing what they do in their van is they're getting funding from somewhere, and it has to be from publicity in the newspapers that they get for solving these crimes. I would probably figure out pretty quickly that, yeah, if they're in the area, maybe they'll save me. But really, I know that it's always a guy in a rubber mask, so I can just pull that rubber mask off and save myself.
Sure.
So I did go with Mystery Inc., but it's more of a, eh, I trust them to save me if they're around, if they're not strung out on whatever's smoking in the back seat and too infatuated with their celebrity friends.
Those kids don't smoke. They're healthy kids.
Yeah, sure they are.
They eat their hashish normally.
I will say that definitely I would want Scooby and the gang to save me and not the other two for precisely the same reason that I would rather watch X-Files than Scooby-Doo, is because it's like weird, terrible, exciting things are happening in the X-Files, and with Scooby-Doo, you kind of know how it's going to go.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, that's that reverse, right? It's like, I would much rather live in a world where that's the worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Listeners, we want to know if any of you picked the X-Files. Head over to majorspoilers.com, cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. Use the comment section to share your reasoning for that. Like Marcus, who says, to save me, definitely Mulder and Scully, but I like Scooby and the gang a lot more. I may have issues with horrible family committing the crime, but if Scooby and the gang are investigating it, there's a great chance I'll be alive, says Spider Lover. Doug Connors says, as annoying as Scooby and the gang are, they always get the job done. With Mulder, I'm liable to wind up kidnapped by aliens or the government. So head over there to Major Spoilers. Cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. Matthew, how has the voting been so far?
3-2-1 against right now. 53 votes. That's my lucky number. 72% leaning towards the Scooby gang. Only 28% leaning towards the X-Files. And I think that's because Mulder and Scully couldn't even keep each other from being abducted by aliens. Because I think Mulder disappeared for like a whole season.
Yeah, but they explained that as he was doing peyote or something.
Was that when the T-1000 was on the show?
Yeah, the T-1000. Yeah, yeah. And then there was some weird young lady who came around, Annabeth Gish. And I'm like, okay,
about the time that I moved and I checked out of the X-Files.
Wait, Robot Patrick was on the show?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
For like 4 years, I want to say. Something like that.
I don't know about that. I want to say more like two. I'm going to say 2 years. But
I was more obsessed with Millennium by that point, so.
Yeah, I was going to say that's around the time when like Millennium was going strong and everybody was like, this is great. And then, Fox shot it in the head.
And then 2000 happened and it was like, oh, well, I guess we can't have Millennium anymore.
Millennium's no fun.
Yeah.
Why? Why would you not be able to have Millennium?
Well, because it was all about end of the world conspiracy stuff.
And the world.
That all ended in
2000. Yep,
midnight.
Oh, man. Bugs. Shorted out everything. We're living in a post-apocalyptic world. Thanks, Scooby and the gang, for saving me.
They shorted out the Mayan calendar.
Yes, they did. I want to thank everyone who's been using Tweaked Audio. A lot of people popping up on Twitter saying, hey, I use Tweaked Audio over at tweakedaudio.com. And best of all, we use the Major Spoilers code MAJOR at checkout, and we save 33%. So we've been talking about them for years. Tweakedaudio.com is the place to go to get some great headphones, some great earbuds. Get it with a microphone built in. Trust me, people, you're going to want that microphone when you're on a long bike ride and someone decides to call you. These things are engineered for durability. They've got the noise reduction design. And like I said, you can save money when you use the checkout code MAJOR at tweakedaudio.com. It's 33%. That's nothing to sneeze at. Thanks, Tweaked Audio, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers podcast. All right, let us talk about Gold Digger. It's something we've been threatening for years, or maybe I've been threatening for years. The rest of them haven't been threatening. They've been cowering, saying, please, no. But you voted, and we're taking a look at Gold Digger Pocket Manga Volume 2. I tried to reach out to Fred Perry, the creator of this series. He never got back to me because I was like, Gold Digger has been going on forever. It started in, 91? And it's still going today, and many consider it the longest-running indie comic. I'm not so sure about that, but it's been going for 20 years, 20-plus years, and I'm amazed that it is continuing to go on and on and on and on and on. That, I think, deserves some recognition right there. There you go. The other thing that really surprised me, because I read some of these when they were originally published in 1981, I read some of these, and at the time, I never made the connection because the thing didn't exist yet. But a few years later, I'm sitting down playing a video game called Tomb Raider, and holy crap, it's exactly what Gold Digger is. She's trying to invade tombs looking for treasure, dressed scantily. So Gold Digger kind of predates that, I found very interesting. And the series is full of pop culture references. You're going to see the Ed 209 pop up. Is it the 209 or the, I forget what it was, from RoboCop?
Yeah, I think it's, Ed 209.
Lightsabers pop up. A bunch of things pop up that are
sort of omens.
Yeah. What is, Matthew, what's this first first arc about? What is this first volume about? Well, not the first volume, second volume about.
There's actually a lot going on in these pages, but the primary thing that happens is that Gina, Gold Digger, and her sister, who's a werecheetah, you know, because reasons, end up getting a terrible evil curse put upon them.
For tomb raiding.
So in order, for raiding tombs, because, you know, like you do. But in order to stop from being cursed, somehow they clone themselves only into one body. So now there's a third girl with enormous cans walking around, and she hates them because she is an embodiment of the curse. And there are some fighty-fighty and some splody-splody and some hats. And a couple of references to Inspector Gadget, which I thought
a lot of references to Inspector Gadget,
yeah, and a lot of interpersonal conflict, and how should I put this delicately? They're boy crazy on several occasions, which was lovely.
Sure, it's the '90s.
Yeah, but in and around the lakes, mountains come out of the sky and stand there. There's a lot of things going on in here, but that basic overarching plot is this evil curse has happened, but it isn't just a question of how do you get rid of the curse. It's like, oh my God, now it's even worse. What do we do? Yeah. Okay, that's even worse. And everything just kind of builds upon itself and snowballs down to, you know, the point where there's a James Bond theme song in play.
And then James Bond shows up. I'm pretty sure that this is supposed to be a comedy. And not a straight up adventure. I mean, there's funny bits, but the one thing that has always just tripped me out because it's actually changed over the years is this whole furry thing, this whole werecheetah thing, Rodrigo. I don't get it.
You don't get it.
I mean,
like,
it doesn't. I mean, I'm trying to figure out the world because there's humans, and then there's suddenly anthropomorphized animals running around.
Right.
Too. And it just seems like it's fairly normal.
That's actually one of the things that I like the most about Gold Digger, because so follow me on this one.
All right.
It takes the same approach to werecheetahs and gender flipping like
genies or
Middle Eastern demons, like that most books take to vampires and werewolves and space aliens and stuff. It's like, there's all these rules that you walk in already knowing. It's like, vampires do this, elves are all archers and they have really good eyesight, dwarves are like this, you know, werewolves are like this. I don't know. Any of these things that we find over and over and over again toxic waste mutates you, you know, stuff like that. And Gold Digger just approaches it like you already know what the hell is happening. It's like, this is the world. None of the characters are weirded out by it. This is all that's happening. And I found that very refreshing for some reason. It's like, rather than, I mean, obviously there are werewolves in it, but werewolves just like one subset. And also they're basically just werified all the time. It's not like they turn into that. It's like there's almost no point in calling them that. You know, it's like something else than we see in most media. So it's like, no, it doesn't make any sense, except if you take a step back, it makes as much sense as any other supernatural thing in any other book.
Sure.
And they really just own it. They just like walk in like it's like perfectly normal. And I was actually really into that.
Actually, is this a fun adventure series? I mean, certainly you have sisters or half sisters that are constantly bickering, doing the sister thing. But there's also this sense of adventure, this Indiana Jones giant quest thing, Tomb Raider thing that's going on. And as much trouble as they get into, it seems like a fairly fun story. Or maybe not.
That's tough for me because I found little to nothing to enjoy in this book.
Okay, tell me. Let's start off from the story side, and then we'll get into the art, which is its own issue.
Right. The art was the main thing that threw me out of the story. I made it 10 pages and then I could not continue. Matthew has a great phrase that I'm going to borrow here. It's not for me, and that's okay. I hope that many people read this and enjoyed it. I think for what it is, it's probably very good. But there's nothing that's going to keep me in this comic. Yeah,
so the biggest problem,
unfortunately,
that I, yeah, the biggest problem here, and I think this was the problem when I read the first couple of issues, was because I think I may have had a pocket manga or something. It was just one of these things. It's like, okay, I'll check it out. I keep seeing these the solicits for it in the previews catalog, so I just want
to
check it out.
And you have to respect the fact that he just keeps making it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, it's like he doesn't care, right? but you get into it, and it's suddenly like, it's the 90s, and so lots of cheesecake pinup shots that leave little to the imagination. And we're dealing mm-hmm. with two female characters, or three female characters running around, plus a fourth that can flip genders and be either a hot guy or hot girl. So a lot of this art is playing
cheesecake.
On the sexual. I wouldn't say cheesecake because it's a little bit more than cheesecake. I mean, there's a lot of gratuitous butt shots. There's like no reason for nipples to be poking through material.
Oh my god!
Yeah, those are some.
There's no reason for the shorts to be yanked up as high as they are on these characters. And
those
that,
look painful. Some
they
of those
do,
wedges.
Right? I mean, that does look really, really bad. And that's problematic. I mean, it's even today I was like, wow, really? I don't remember it being this bad back then. But also I remember not continuing that series past that first volume that I picked up because yeah. I was just like, no, this is not for me. But
yeah,
go ahead, Matthew.
That I think is my biggest issue with it. I have no problem with characters being sexual. I have no problem with characters being sexy.
No,
I have no problem with a story being pornographic and just being pornography. But there's, I don't want to be incredibly cruel, but there's a puerility. Is that it's puerile in some way,
yeah.
mm-hmm. where you have just the characters are talking and they're standing there and they're like, we have to do this and we have to undo this curse. And you know, you've got these massive, these massive bulbous cans on display. And I'm like, it doesn't even feel like it's there just for the Jigglypuff
right. so,
factor.
As you said, there's nothing wrong with pornography. There's nothing wrong with sex. There's nothing wrong with characters being sexual. But
no.
is there a problem when it becomes gratuitous for gratuitousness?
I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that if that's what you know going into it what you're there for. Like, I read Sunstone because I know exactly what that is.
Right.
And for me, that is appealing. Whereas like this for me is unappealing. Mm. And I don't want to say that it's degrading because that's like definitely a step further. But it makes it difficult for me to be like, oh, this might actually be like a cute, fun adventure story about these weird, sexy girls. When I'm trying not to be like, that cat has nipples though. Yeah.
But if it were, let me ask
but
this.
Only two.
Let me answer this. If they toned down, if Fred, and this is all single creator, this is Fred Perry doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it were toned down, if the clothes fit, would this be a better story? Or Rodrigo, is this simply just about sexy lady people's cats?
So this is interesting. This, I mean, Gold Digger is just such a like beautiful example of that kind of indie comic thing where it's like, here's somebody who is approaching it as comedy with like a hefty amount of fan service and being like, ha ha ha, look, girls with big boobies. And this is funny. But like, you can tell that there's a story underneath, a story right. that they want to tell. And although in the short term, it pays off because you're like, oh, a funny story with boobies. Who doesn't mm-hmm. love that?
Right.
It actually works against the narrative. It's the reason, I mean, that is the reason why, even though Steven swears up and down that there's an actual plot to
I think there
all
is.
The Zendoscope to all the Zenoscope books, I don't believe them. Because I look at those covers and I'm like, there couldn't be. There couldn't possibly be.
Well, you know, to make matters worse, they have a sale going on right now at Comixology for 69% off.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. See, it's like they're not helping their own case. And it's like, again, you can read a comic that is very sexual or very sexy and be surprised by how funny or interesting or sexy or sexual or whatever it is, you know, as long as the writer, I think, goes in with this like clear goal to do that. But I think these issues of Gold Digger are very often working against themselves, you know. There's kind of this story that's trying to unfold, but we have to spend all this time on talking about boobs and on boob shots. And you just kind of lose part of it.
I know. And that's what's really weird. And that's what's, I don't know. It feels weird because if you go over to Fred Perry's DeviantArt page, he's got like new stuff. I mean, this is still going on and you can see it. And there's this kind of interesting storyline called Gina Digger's Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., where she wakes up in the Marvel Universe. And it's really cool, cartoony art. It kind of looks a little bit like the Empowered stuff, but maybe a little more tunified. And it's not hypersexual, and it's not, I mean, yes, there is a character with giant breasts, but it's an actual story with composition and layout and design. I mean, I'm not saying that this series that we're reviewing doesn't, but I think what I'm getting at is his style improves and changes over time. And I think it becomes much more about the gimmick. It becomes much less about the gimmick and much more about a story and the craft. And I think that is something that is interesting as well.
This is very obviously the work of a young creator, learning his strengths and weaknesses and having a lot of good things going for him. I mean, if you just break it down from the perspective of coming in cold, you've got a book with two main female characters. It's not like Danger Girl where they all work for Sean Connery. It's not something where, and yes, they're frequently naked or half naked. And they do have a lot of issues with the fact that Gina's cleavage literally goes down past her ankles. I don't even know how that works. Fabric doesn't do that, but that's okay. Again, a young creator kind of learning his way through these issues. And there are sparks in here where I'm like, okay, that's a really good panel, or that was some really good dialogue, or this concept of the curse given human form and it's a combined form of the two of them.
Yeah,
that's clever. That's something that I'm like, you wouldn't necessarily expect to see that.
Just real quick, is like the whole curse thing is like just such a golden age of comics.
I know,
thing,
right?
Yeah, it really is.
It's a great concept. How do we get rid of this?
I know. Let's create a brand new person. It's like, ding! What? This is some like Legion shows up in your time period stuff.
I mean, that's what makes this story fun is like, hey, we're having this adventure. Sure. Here's how we get rid of a curse. We put it into some other body. That's an amalgam of both of us. I mean, that's brilliant.
And that's the thing that really kind of works. And this is where you can see why the fans of this book are so massively fans of it. The people who've been reading this book for 25 years now, you start from this point, and you know, sometimes I think back and I go, okay, well, let's talk about early installment weirdness on the things that I love.
Oh yeah,
let's go back to, you know, like the second season of Super Sentai, or God help us, that volume 2 of New Warriors. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there where I'm just like, nope, not gonna talk. We do not speak of it.
Right. Well, like, you know, I think
Worf effect.
I mean, I haven't read Gold Digger in forever, and this is probably the first time I've read it in 25 years or whatever. But it looks like from his DeviantArt page that it moves more away from what we're seeing in here and moves more into a more manga, traditional manga stylings that we were familiar with. And the, maybe the gratuitousness becomes a little bit more cheesecake and not as, and I don't want to say explicit, but not as in your face as what we see in this first volume.
Not as overt.
Yeah. And it looks like there's more focus on story and, you know, here are some cat ladies and some regular ladies and everything that's going on, and they're having adventures. And sometimes they're hugging each other a little too close, and sometimes they're just posing for a pinup. So, I mean, take that with a grain of salt. Personally, I liked the spirit of this story. I like the concept of here's this Tomb Raider type girl who is trying to make her millions by going and raiding these tombs, and yet it never works out for her, and they have to figure out ways to solve this and in ways that don't always work. I love the pop culture references. As much as I don't understand why there's your half sister is a were-cheetah, I can dig it. From that aspect of it, I like the spirit of this volume. That being said, I'm not sure I can recommend it. I think you really have to be in the right frame set to check this out. And maybe if you're going to start with Gold Digger, if you've never read it before, never checked it out before, maybe check out one of the more recent issues. Don't go back into the archives. Don't deep dive into this collection, but stay in the near times, because you might have a better experience that way. That's kind of my bottom line with this. Ashley?
I really respect that this comic was made and what it represents, a lot like the original Tick. It's the same kind of spirit, I think, just less deftly executed. I think if you're a 16-year-old boy, this is probably one of the best times you can have with comics, and you should absolutely pick it up and read it in your blanket fort while your mom is away.
Or just in the other room, right?
Yeah, sure. Depending on how daring you feel, 16-year-old boy. I don't think I can really recommend it in good faith, but it's cool that this exists.
Yeah. Matthew?
Well, what it really comes down to is, as Ashley said, I do like to say that things are not for me and that's okay. So when I come into something that I don't have an emotional attachment to the characters and I don't have an immediate love of an artist or an immediate story that just kind of grabs me by the scruff of the neck and says, you're going to read this now. If I have all of that, what I really break down is, what's the comic craft? As someone who's like, I like comics and I don't care about characters, can I say that this is a really skilled creator doing really skilled, new, awesome things with comics? No, but I can tell you that it's a creator with potential early on in his career, doing things that are interesting and mostly unique. There's really nothing like this that I can think of right off the top of my head that I've read and go, this is exactly like it. But then there's also the fact that it is very much aimed at not me. It's aimed, I think, at an audience who, for whatever reason, you have a love of the character, you get into the whole thing of the Indiana Jones, or maybe you like the fact that there's a werecheetah. All of that plays into it. For me, it just feels really young. It feels kind of immature. And while I can say there are people I would recommend this to, I will not make a recommendation for this simply because of the fact that if I want my pornography, I want it to be pornography and be honest about that. And if it's not pornography, I feel like I want a little more story and a little more cohesiveness and maybe a little more polish on the art before I'll say that something is definitely, yes, this is a big deal. And oh my God, some of these boob shots are just like, really?
Yeah, I got to the point as I was going through this as of like, okay, just focus on the word balloons and look at the, you know, kind of, you know how you can kind of blur your eyes.
Unfortunately, the other balloons are bigger.
Look at the overall scope of it without, you know, focusing in on the fine details. I think that made it easier to get through. Rodrigo, bottom line for you.
Just edit out the nipples. That's what you should do.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Rodrigo, for you.
I think Gold Digger, I think there's a lot to like in Gold Digger, but most of the time, like almost 100% of the time, the book is just getting in its own way. There's a weird, quirky story set in a weird, quirky world that is like really harkens back to like old school comics. Also, there's a tee-hee-hee big giant booby book, and they're they're fighting. They're like fighting for attention. They're fighting for screen time, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, unfortunately, the boobies win. So I wouldn't. I would also follow that with saying that maybe future or issues that come after this might be better. But I can't really recommend this volume just because it's kind of, again, just constantly fighting itself for what it actually wants to do.
It's interesting because this volume is black and white, the manga pocket editions that you can still get. You can't get it on Comixology. The Comixology stuff starts with the color series, which I think is like 95, 96. So you're getting, you know, there's 4 years of stuff that happened before the color series begins at Comixology that probably shows a change in craft and story and other things. So it's interesting that the older stuff is not there or easily accessible to most people.
Yeah.
So if you go look for Gold Digger, it's up to like, Matthew, do you remember it's like up to 200 issues something? We always joke about it.
It's over 200. It's I want to say it's in the 230s.
Yeah, we joke about it all the time on the Dueling Review podcast. What is Dueling Review podcast?
Oh, it's a podcast where two nerds, that would be me and Steven, sit down with a comic and we go into it in depth. And what happens is one of us is right and the other is Steven. And for half an hour, we debate the merits of any given book.
Let's talk about who's right. Matthew, would you like to share your cheese ball eating experience this weekend?
No. No, I'm good. No. Robin, talk to your brother.
All right. We'll bring this up about who's right about stuff in the future.
Talk to me, Robin. Talk to me.
So, yeah, go check out the Dueling Review podcast. It's a lot of fun. Gold Digger 236 is the most recent issue on that. Ashley, what's going on with you? Where can people find more of your stuff besides comic books?
Oh, my God. Well, you can find the IF Anthology in previews right now. Order it. It comes out on November 30th. Me and Jason Emmon wrote the very first story in the book, so you don't even have to read the rest of it. And look out for Love is Love hitting shelves in December. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ashley V. Robinson and the Geek History Lesson podcast on the Major Spoilers podcast feed.
This week you're talking Flashpoint, so everybody wants to listen to that before the October 4th debut of the Flash Season 3.
Exactly.
So go do check that out. Rodrigo, where can people find more of you?
At Fearsome Critter on Twitter, Magic Turtle on Tumblr. Although I've been really seriously neglecting my Tumblr recently. Also on a few shows on the Major Spoilers Network. It's good times. Also, I wrote a book, The Tale of Tallest Rabbit. Go find it on Amazon because rent is due.
And finally, Matthew, who finally listened to me and is eating his cheese balls with chopsticks. Where can people find more about you?
You have no proof of that.
I can prove it. I can point your Facebook page.
Well, fortunately for me, I had a wonderful discussion with my boss who said that cellular phones are no longer permitted in the workplace, but my tablet is not a cellular phone, so I once again have access during the day to my social media at Mighty King Cobra. You can follow me on the Tumblr at Mighty King Cobra. When Rodrigo is not following his Tumblr, I don't have anything to retumble because I know like five people in the universe. So we're both kind of in a Tumblr fuzz. But if you follow me,
you can
at Mighty King Cobra.
You can retumble Rob stuff.
So yeah, I can't retumble anything with Rodrigo neglecting his thing. But I'll be happy to talk to you on the Twitter. You know, every day at noon, I do a thing with a thing and a thing. And every once in a while, I show up and I do these awesome shows at a place called MajorSpoilers.com. We got 15 podcasts. I'm on 7 of them.
And we might have more coming. We can only do that with your support. Ooh, Patreon.MajorSpoilers.com. If you are a Patreon member, you know what one of the potential upcoming shows is about because we talked about it on our monthly live chat. You can find out more, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week for the Major Spoilers podcast. It's a lot of fun, a lot of good discussion. And next week, we will be taking a look at The Adventures of Wally Fresh, Volume 1. Why? Because we know that you love comics. We do, too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. Spider-Man's a clone. Stop spending all
podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.